The next item on the agenda is a little section on what climate change adaptation research might look like. It's boldly titled The Science of Biodiversity Adaptation. I'll start off by saying I'm not sure that there is a science of biodiversity adaptation. But it's our job to try and imagine what it might be and the sorts of tools that might be helpful for imagining what the future looks like. Because I guess a couple of points that might come out of the next couple of talks is, if you're going to imagine the future, you need some tools to sort of do some scenario setting and think about what we've got at the moment, how it might change, and therefore how we might react to a potential suite of changes as outlined by clever people and clever models. So to me, this is an idiosyncratic and personal view of adaptation. And my aim here is to light a few matches and chuck them into the sward of dry grass and then run away completely and turn around and look at my handiwork. But climate change adaptation to me, I mean, it's one of four key areas of research in climate change, about the causes of climate change, the science, the atmospheric science essentially, and oceanographic science of cause. Impacts on biological communities and human communities. The science of mitigation as well. What is it that we need to do to actually turn around emissions, and how do we know that we're tracking, and adaptation. So I guess in one sense we've had 20 years, 30 years, well, depending on how far back you go, probably 100 years if you go back to Arrhenius, of thinking about the causes of climate change, the relationship between greenhouse gases and atmospheric temperatures. Impact research, again, has decades of research grunt behind it. Mitigation, increasingly, I mean, the engineering principles, as can be applied, again, relatively well understood. Adaptation, it's difficult because it involves people making choices. And that's, I guess, if there's one thing we have to wrestle with, it's that. If you go to the NCARF website and ask about adaptation, there's different sorts of ways of doing it. Actions might vary in time, the spatial and temporal scope, what you do it for, and the agency by which you try to affect change. So there's various ways of going about doing it, but I don't reckon there's an off-the-shelf way. I don't even think that there's, a multiple or syndrome of ways necessarily. So there's a proposition. There's no off-the-shelf way of doing adaptation business. Maybe we can think about how we might turn that around. Part of the reason is that the complexity and confidence associated with any aspect of climate change is a problem. This is a diagram that I've stolen from Graham Pearman, atmospheric scientist and long-term climate change researcher in Australia. And he sort of thinks about it in terms of the primary drivers on the left-hand side, and then what happens to bits of the economy, society, landscape over on the right-hand side, and how vulnerable things might be and what we might do about it. And really, he sort of thinks of it, the left-hand side as the easy bit. The physics, chemistry and biology of climate change is relatively well understood and can be imagined and understood according to the laws of physics and chemistry. The stuff over on the right-hand side is hard stuff, and that's where people making choices means a great deal. We were on the wireless this morning, Steve and I, and the ABC Country Hour lass asked, something about uncertainty. And Steve's point was, well, most of the uncertainty, and reiterated in one of the slides he said, most of the uncertainty that's involved in imagining how hot we're going to be in 2070 is not to do with the understanding of biophysical models. It's to do with choices we make about how many tonnes of carbon dioxide we emit as a community or as individuals. So that's why adaptation, to me, is an interesting one, and why there's no off-the-shelf product. We work with our mates, and here's some lessons from a neighbour that's probably going to win the State of Origin tonight. This is some work that we're doing for the Queensland Government. I've just highlighted a couple of key ideas here. Areas of high endemism are important. You don't need to necessarily
read the whole town. Oh, but you do need to note there's a lot of Williams references in there, none of which are mine, but I take them vicariously. I'm going to write a paper with Steve and Yvette one day, and it's going to be Williams, Williams and Williams. It's going to be great. The velocity of change. Interestingly, there's surprises in some of the work that we've done, trying to work out, you know, the rates at which things might change. And the whole idea of novel climates, climates that don't exist at the moment and that will become apparent in the next 50 years, climates that do exist at the moment that are going to go extinct. So these are sort of big ticket items that we need to think about as, you know, the template for our thinking about adaptation. Stephen Garnett showed this graph. Refugia is something that comes up all the time. So we're thinking about adaptation, how does biodiversity adapt to a changing climate? Refugia are important. And so how do we manage refugia? How do we make decisions about refugia in landscapes to maximise the chance of persistence of key elements of the biota? The issue of things that are changing and things that are happening and things that are problematic already has come up, and here's some data from again from Kakadu, courtesy of John Wanowski et al, just on the problem of mammal decline in Kakadu. So whether you look at number of individuals or numbers of species over the last decade or so, there has been a dramatic decline in numbers. The social question I asked before is, well, what's acceptable? Is this acceptable? How do managers think about this? How do we approach this sort of essential moral problem, given that we've got a nice sort of objective set of scientific data? How do we make decisions about how we react to that? I'll put up one reaction from Corey Bradshaw, professor at the University of Adelaide, on his blog just last week. Kakadu is no longer Australia's conservation jewel. It's now the conservation dunny. Bit dramatic. I don't necessarily agree with that, but you know, how do you react to data like this? Is this an understatement, overstatement, contestable area for discussion, I am sure. Corey has never been known for being backward in putting his opinions. We're into it already, so thanks, Steve. Whatever it is, I think we have to adopt a sort of no-regrets policy. What are the sort of things that we do, that we would do anyway, that we're not going to regret? And reducing fire frequency is one of them. Part of the no-regrets sort of ways of looking for, at least in the savannas, and thinking about landscape management, fire being one of them, is we do have a problem now with introduced grasses. Do something about gamba grass now is a no-regrets biodiversity adaptation option. Not easy but to do socially, but conceptually it's very, very straightforward. If you can identify areas where you've got co-benefits, multiple sort of benefits that come from particular actions, and the sort of work that's going on in West Arnhem Land, the Walfa type projects, where we're trying to reduce emissions by doing fire management better. By reducing emissions, you also get enhanced carbon sequestration benefits potentially for biodiversity and remote community well-being. So all working in the same direction, and it's a potential and successful model for adaptation work elsewhere in the territory or in the country. I thought we'd also finish off with a well-known part of the Northern Territory, the Bogong High Plains in Victoria. I also work in Victoria's High Country. The High Country is vulnerable because it's, as Steve said, the top of the mountain in Australia. We've got relatively low relief with rising temperatures. You've got nowhere else to go. So we've been looking at this for the last 6 or 7 years and experimentally trying to warm little bits of the High Country up. So little bits of grassland, surround them with a square metre of perspex and warm it up, see what happens. We've also got the benefit of long-term monitoring that's been going on since the 1940s in parts of the Bogong High Plains in similar sorts of communities where we're doing our experimental work. What it means is that we are able to sort of induce change in diversity, in genetics, in composition, monitor a whole swag of things and put it in the context of what change we've been able to observe because we've had 60 years worth of monitoring. And really, interestingly, it turns out to be that at least over the last 7 or 8 years, we haven't really been able to induce anything by warming the grassland up by 2 degrees that hasn't been seen before. It's all within the bounds of change that's happened in the last 60 years. So we're reasonably confident that we've got a resilient story here initially in terms of biodiversity. What that means for managers is that there is potential room to move and to think about the other sorts of things that are current threats to the high country rather than immediately trying to think about adapting to a warmer world. It's a million-dollar conclusion in the sense that that's what it's cost to reach that, but I think that's a reasonable investment. It's also identified what we might need to think about. What are the things to be concerned about? Native shrubs on the move, making the high country more woody, and weeds in general have always come up in climate change work, and the conclusion is, well, monitor so that you know what is going on. So there's some simple messages there for agencies and governments. I think we need to be bold. I think be bold and explicit about the sorts of things that we are trying to do. Recognising that climate change is real, the risks are real, and we're going to try something. But it's unknown space. Even to say that failure is an option. Try something and suck it and see. Things are going to change. I think we need to start thinking about that message and how we apply that practically. And probably hard decisions are going to be made and going to be needed. So the whole area of triage and identifying priorities in landscapes, but again, being bold and explicit about what we're trying to do is going to be part of the narrative. So Adam's next, and he's going to tell us a little bit about scenario modelling that we've been applying to some projects that we've been involved in through this lab in the Territory and in Queensland. Then it's over to you, Mob, after lunch when we've heard from various stakeholders as well. So after Adam's talk, we'll get into four other talks. But really, from here on in, a couple of things. All of what we're talking about is contestable, and I think we need to wrestle, recognise that, and wrestle with the sort of contestability of the sort of ideas that we are coming up with. And I think that can be quite good fun. So we're after ideas. We're trying to imagine what the future might look like, so we really want you to have your imaginative thinking caps on. Cross the hemispheres, if you can, left and right hand. And, you know, have a think about the sort of one big, transformative, challenging idea that you might have been hearing today. We might make a list of those after lunch. So Adam's next, but think about where it is we want to be. Thanks.